first off, can you just kind of tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to start Fresh Start Learning?
Sure. I am a mother of five and a grandma of four beautiful grandsons. And I started Fresh Start about 10 years ago working in adult-based education, early childhood education for those that work with our child care centers and after-school programs. In that, I found that there was a lot of advocacy needed for women that had gone through trauma-based lifestyles, because I would get a lot of conversations afterwards about things that were happening inside of their homes. Didn't have anything to do with the class that I was teaching, but it also opened back up the door of some things that I had neatly packed away for myself, meaning that I had some things that I had not dealt with either. Trauma-based lifestyles, unwanted touches, domestic issues, sexual assault, rape, those kind of things. And in those classes, one lady just kind of sparked everything when she raised her hand, a middle-aged Caucasian lady, in the midst of her peers, and said that her brother had been molesting her from early childhood all the way up to adulthood, but she had never told anyone. And then that made it absolutely understandable to me that I needed to just unpack some of the things that I had neatly packed away, because by society's standpoint, I was doing great. I was delivered and set free from drugs and alcohol. I was no longer on the street. I was no longer trapped inside of any kind of trafficking situations. My life had turned around. I went back to school, but I'd never dealt with the trauma as much as I needed to. So Fresh Start started off by doing what was called the I Am a Survivor Women's Empowerment Group first.
This is always sensitive, and so please forgive me if I overstep, I'm just, whatever you're willing to share, can you tell me kind of your own personal story of how you became involved in sex trafficking?
Well, like I always say, it's really not a cookie cutter thing. It's just unresolved trauma, being taken advantage of in a lot of different ways growing up. We have some things that we should not have experienced at a young age, which makes us more vulnerable when we become an adult. So for me, it was those unwanted touches, not being able to tell someone, or felt like I couldn't tell my parents what was going on. Then that last experience of that rape episode, and then having an appetite to hang out with older people because I wanted to fit somewhere and didn't quite know where to fit. So I started drinking at a young age and started smoking marijuana, the gateway drug, and led into harder drugs. 17 years old, fully addicted to crack cocaine and alcohol. And my best friend at the time was 20 years older than I was, approximately, and her boyfriend was like the biggest drug dealer, and her brother was a pimp, and he had another brother that aspired to be one, apparently, because he set eyes on me. I received his advances about, you don't no longer need to be a broke hoe, you can be a paid hoe, and that, I thought that was like music to my ears. So many times I had been taken advantage of, and at this point I finally have an opportunity to pay back, in other words, some of the hurt that I felt like I experienced by getting a monetary amount of money for performing things that was taken from me, and then had the love, or the so-called love, of this guy that really said that I was his everything, but not really knowing that I was just his commodity. Found that out pretty quickly when I did not realize I had a quota after being on the truck stops, where I was introduced to my first experience of sexual exploitation was truck stops, and then private parties and escort services and things like that. So the time that I was really sleepy after being in on a binge and went back because a guy let me sleep in his truck, I really found out at that point that he was really not my boyfriend. He really didn't love me like he said he did, because I did not have what he said I should have had when I came in, which I never knew I had a quota. At that time, I start fighting for his love and attention, because then he started bringing other girls in. And in order for me to lay next to him at night, I would have to make sure I had my quota. And this happened for a few years, just doing it on the weekends and not really raising too many eyebrows from my parents and my siblings. They kind of knew something was going on, but didn't quite know what. And because I always had the money and always, splurging on people, I didn't get a lot of questions asked. And I wish I would have.
You said that you didn't realize you had a quota. I mean, can you talk about that, too? I mean, how does it all work, because for you it was just you really needed the money and you wanted the income, because it was it for the drugs, or was it because of the lifestyle and you wanted to support yourself? Or can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the quota comes in when that person believes that you as their commodity should be able to bring in a certain amount of money. And until you get that money, you can't come in. But you never realize that until it's actually brought to your attention. But the grooming process of me believing that that was my boyfriend would not allow me to believe that I was actually for sale at, you know, at his dispense. I was doing it not for just the money. I did have a drug addiction that I needed to pay for, and he had one as well. So I figured that it was my obligation to make sure we had what we needed, and it was his obligation to make sure that he had a place for us to be, and to he did drug dealing on the side by the money that I brought in. And, you know, so it was one of those things. The main thing is because the love and attention and the lifestyle is the biggest thing to keep you caught there, even when you want to get away, because you create this whole new fairy tale lifestyle where everybody is applauding you. Everybody wants you. Your name is ringing in the air. You know, people think you're so beautiful. You know, the guys that you're sleeping with, they pay so much attention to you, and you feel at some point that you really have power, especially if you felt like your power was taken away by unresolved trauma, like I spoke about before. And when you're in the rooms with those guys and they're throwing money at you for private dancing, or you're an escort and you're going out to eat in the fine restaurants, and then you go back to sleep with this guy at night and he gives you the money, you feel accomplished, because at the end of the day, your trophy is that guy that's waiting back at the hotel or home or wherever you guys are living at, that he says, job well done. You know, so that was one of the biggest things that always made me feel at least a little bit more assured about what I was doing, because I felt like I fit.
And how did it start out with him? You said that it was your friend's boyfriend, or?
It was my friend's brother. She had two brothers. One was already a pimp, and he had a few girls that he had doing the same thing that I was getting ready to enter into the life of doing. And his brother, you know, hung out with us, and we drank, and we, you know, did cocaine together. And he approached me with the opportunity to make more money, you know, to make money, you know, and not be taken advantage of. And he kind of put it in more so like he would be able to manage or produce a way for me to do that. Plus, I could be his girlfriend, you know, and we could do this together, kind of like a Bonnie and Clyde thing. So it wasn't introduced as anything wrong. It was very appealing at the time. And it seems like the right thing to do, especially when you're not in your right mind. You know, you figure, I got this cocaine habit, I got this drinking problem, I got these older people I'm hanging around with, and everybody else in this crowd is actually doing it, and they seem okay, and why not? You know, so that was more so of the lure for me.
And how old were you again when this all started?
17.
Were you at home, living at home, or where were you?
Yeah, you know what? I was living at home with my mom and my sister. And like I said, my best friend at the time lived right next door to us. She was from Rockford, Illinois, and she lived right next door to us. So I kind of met that whole group of people in my neighborhood at the time, and kind of start hanging out and, you know, smoking weed first, like I said, and then start dabbling in the other harder drugs. Start traveling around with her a lot, going to Rockford where her boyfriend was, you know, selling drugs at, and kind of hung out and got a chance to meet some of the family. And that's how it all was introduced. Again, it was more so weekends and things like that. So my mom didn't raise an eyebrow. She was raising me, and all of my other siblings were adults at that time. So she was working, and she was, you know, just kind of living her life as well. So I kind of went underneath the radar, so to speak. So she really didn't notice until my drug habits started getting really out of control. By that time, it was totally too late.
Mm. And you said around the neighborhood, where was this all happening? In Milwaukee, or?
Yeah. I met everyone in Milwaukee. We lived on North 45th Street off of 45th North Avenue. And I did a lot of the work at the truck stops up north. Up not I-94. We did a lot of work around in Illinois, you know, so Indiana, you know, so we traveled wherever we could, Michigan, you know, so wherever we found ourselves at, wherever the money was actually traveling to, that's where we went.
So you were always on the road?
Pretty much always on the road. I only started doing things in Milwaukee once I got away from him and became what they call a renegade. So I didn't no longer had a guy that was overseeing me. I kind of took all the tools that I learned and started using those tools in Milwaukee to continue on with. At that point, they would have called it prostitution, but I was still being coerced by the drugs and still being enlightened by the lifestyle, and kept hanging out and finding places to make the money at as well.
Well, and how was he? How are you making this happen? Because I'm thinking, like, was it all because, like, there were stops along the way for drugs, or was it intentional? Like, there were people that he went to in these communities because he knew that they wanted sex.
His brother more so knew, because he was the one that had the established trafficking ring, you know, but what they called it, family. You know, I know better now, but so he had places where they frequent a lot. So they're like dance places where we would go dance at. But the truck stops are all along, you know, the I-94 corridor. So the truck stops like the TNA and the 76 and things like that. They used to call us lot lizards, because wherever the truck stops were, there were a lot of, you know, clientele that were there. So we would go to the truck stops, drop in the trucks, learn how to talk on the CB, watch for the guys to hit their back brakes or what have you. And we learned all about the different kind of trucks so that we could, you know, make money at the truck stops in between going to the other places where we found a hotel room and we did escort services, or we went out and we went to clubs and we danced.
They called you lot lizards, or the guys that at the truck stops lot lizards?
No, the young ladies that are selling their bodies for an exchange for money or drugs were the lot lizards.
I mean, was this all over Wisconsin? Or, because I know you said Wisconsin, Illinois, and Michigan. I mean, how far would they take you into Wisconsin?
I mean, you know, going back in my mind, I really was a blur about where we stopped at. I just know a couple of places because I remember us going back to the same places all the time. So when I just keep indicating the I-94 corridor, when you go up and down that small rural communities, when you are going through, you know, like going up north, any place that you saw a rest stop or a truck stop where there was a lot of trucks at, we went there just to see. So they will wait for us at a local restaurant, or they'll wait for us and get a motel room, and they'll drop us off, and we would begin to solicit some of the men, you know, immediately. And then from that point, once we got in our first truck, we could continue to, you know, talk on the CBs, and they knew the language. So we would just talk about, we were out there and what we had, and I was Brown Sugar. The girl that was with me was Sugar Bridges, and we would just kind of do the lingo, and then we would have our next client from that truck. We jump into the next truck, you know, things like that. So it was that kind of thing. So it was always on the fly, wherever we could make money at. Yes, true. But there was a lot of places where we frequent quite often.
And what do you mean when you say that they knew the lingo? Like on the CB, were there like phrases that you used to let them know, hey, you know, I'm here? Or
correct.
Code.
You know, we just talked about that we're out there if anybody was looking for any company, you know, and then just kind of sounded kind of saying that, like, if we were in a Peterbilt or we were in a flatbed or what have you, and just kind of give the lingo, and then, you know, copy that, or, you know, and then they'll come back and be like, you know, look, I'm third row or what have you, Peterbilt, flatbed, whatever they were driving. And then we're like, why don't you hit your brakes for me 2 times, you know? And they'll do it, and we'll know where they were at, you know. So it wasn't a lot of language on the CB, but it was enough language where they understood what was happening.
And how long was it for you before you realized exactly what was happening? I know you said that, you know, you didn't realize you had a quota until you came back one night and he said you didn't get enough. But, like, when did you realize that you were being trafficked for sex?
after that day, I mean, it's not, and we never use that word. And that's the problem right now, that people or young girls will not identify because you say that word. That word is associated with, you know, Hollywood, the movies, you know, Taken, you know, SUV, you know, that kind of stuff. So it doesn't really resonate with a young lady or young man that is being groomed or loved on or so to be loved on by somebody that they care about. And especially if you have other vices or where you're drug addicted or on opiates or whatever the case may be, we never think that that's happening, you know. So it's kind of like one of those modern day brainwashing where you don't think that this is actually what's happening, especially with that terminology. When we talk about it on the state level and how we define it with coercion, manipulation, and things like that, we understand that language, but you're talking to somebody that believes this person has their best interests at heart. And that this is a person that took me out of a bad situation or protected me from a bad situation or made me feel special or, you know, or allowed me to feel like I'm independent or you know, so if there's so many different reasonings that come behind it, but it's never that we believe that we've been trafficked.
Okay.
It's only after you come out, you know, pretty much that you understand it, because now somebody's actually educating you on the grooming process, the coercion, the manipulation, you know, your vulnerabilities, what happened, you know. Going back over my life now, I look at a lot of things that I didn't really realize that was not beneficial for me, because when you're in the life, guess what? It's part of the life. It doesn't really cause itself to be anything other than what it is. If you are not going along with the things that happen, you are the outcast at that point, more so than it is if you're going along with it and you feel like everything's cohesive. Everybody's doing it. Everybody's drinking. Everybody's shooting cocaine. Everybody's taking pills. Everybody's doing mollies. Everybody, because it, at that point, it pretty much is. So there's no distinction that something is wrong.
So when did you get out, or how long has it been since you got out?
Well, it's been years. I stopped counting them. But I had a lot of stints of sobriety in and out of the life. When I got away from my trafficker, I can say that I never did have another a trafficker in that aspect. What ended up happening, I went to drug rehab when I was in my early 20s, at 20 years old. And at that point, I went to the Army. I went to the reserves when I was, and it got back out in 21. I met a guy that was there, and he ended up being very domestically, a domestic violence situation where I ended up using again, but I didn't have a pimp or a overseer or a trafficker or a producer or anything. He was just my boyfriend at the time. And I ended up having children by him, and it just continued to be that kind of next trauma-based situation I found myself in. But in between those stints of sobriety and in between going back to school and in between discovering myself and all of that, I kept exchanging my man card in for another man, you know, hoping that it would get better. You know, so I have three children by my abuser, a domestic abuser. I have a son by my a guy that was kind of like a low-key Romeo pimp. He really knew what I was doing. So if it afforded him to be able to get his drugs, he was cool with it. So he really didn't put me on the street as far as the other guy did. But he was a person that was a well-known to do and associate itself around those kind of things. So those kind of things continued to happen on and off. And to some point, like I said, I was actually living my life out to the fullest, establishing fresh start, and I was still going through domestic issues, still coming off a stint of sobriety. So it took it took me and my faith based in Christ for it to completely stop. When I said yes, and I went all in and said, you know what, God, I don't want this anymore. I started reaching out to those resources that were available for me, like counseling, like prayer, my pastor, talking to people. Then it changed. You know, then opportunities start presenting itself where I was able to now do roundtables like I spoke about before with the I'm a Survivor Women's Empowerment Group, and then started doing advocacy trainings. And then Fresh Start continued to grow in a matter of outreach and mission projects and speaking engagements and, you know, going to high schools and going to junior high schools. I mean, so all of that continued to happen over the years. It's been 10 plus years for sure that I haven't had any drugs or alcohol or even been involved with any type of abusive situation, you know, so it is definitely an everyday journey. And every day I'm grateful.
It's just so much to go through. I mean, how, when you're working at Fresh Start, I mean, like, what are some of the things that you encounter, or how are you putting this personal experience that you've had to work to help young women or men?
We do an outreach program called Feet on the Street Outreach. We go out on the street at least 2 to 3 times out of the week. And we have what's called the Purposeful Purse. God gave that ideal and that notion to start the conversation. So it's kind of like our olive branch of love. We have it filled with toiletries, the everyday essentials that people would need. Not saying these ladies couldn't buy themselves, but at least gives us an opportunity to start the conversation. And we have resources in there, not identifiable resources, saying that, are you being trafficked? Are you being domestically abused? You want to get off the street, because that would put us in jeopardy as well as the ladies, especially with their overseers or the traffickers watching. So we have conversations on the street. We provide food. We provide clothing, winter gear when it's winter, bottles of water, things like that in the summer. So, and we've been out in the community for about 4 years doing that. And we had great success with women coming in off the street, coming into the survivor groups, started to do transitional living, going to alcohol and drug treatment centers. And I've also been involved with at-risk youth facilities that I go and do practical application trainings. That's called Next Steps, talking to the young ladies that are court ordered there and have been deemed trafficked or had an overseer. And we do training with them every week, talking about the what ifs and talking about what will happen when you leave here, and being able to help them to identify resources. And we do crisis stabilization, family crisis stabilization, support groups. We have a drop-in location now where we can take 7 women in off the street Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and we'll soon be doing Monday. We're always seeking volunteers so we can be open 7 days a week for that aha moment that actually happens. So we're doing everything that we possibly can, collaborating with people that are doing legal help for people that been trafficked, to get their families back, to get rid of some of those tickets that actually happen so they can get their life back in order, with healthcare initiative programs to help them get acclimated back into getting insurance, getting screenings for STIs or STDs. You know, so we're thinking about the whole gamut, the whole person, and connecting with people that can help young ladies and young men get back into, we don't want to say a normal life, but at least a life that they never experienced or need to experience again.
Well, you know, when we talked over the phone, I was mentioning how I'm heading to this event that where the folks there are doing free cover-ups for girls who have been tattooed as a result of sex trafficking. And you said that you've encountered that with women that you work with?
Oh, absolutely. And even girls that I was actually out there with at the time. There's what they call branding. It actually gives an opportunity to let other people know who that woman or that young man belonged to. They're identifiable through gang culture as well, meaning that they have certain tattoos that are gang related that require the young ladies to actually have those, because her source of giving back to her gang family would be to, you know, sell her wares as well. So they don't call that even trafficking, but it is. Then you have the men that actually have what they call a stable of women, meaning having more than 3 women that are underneath him, that he tattoos them either with his nickname, or a dollar sign, or a Louis Vuitton, like VL on her, that says she's a high price hoe, or, you know, on her neck or in the center of her back where it's identifiable if she's dancing or things like that. You know, it's just a lot of different type of tattoos that are utilized to let other people in that lifestyle, in that culture, know that this is why she has this. If you ever do a Google search and you put human trafficking tattoos or tattoos associated with human trafficking, you'll see a lot of them come up because they are identifiable through the police stations when they take pictures of it. And then they post those too, so other people can recognize it. But now in today's world, because you have so many people getting tatted for different reasons, it's kind of a little bit more difficult to identify than it would be if it wasn't like it was back then.
And you said women that you were with back then, like, I don't know if this was, you said you were Brown Sugar and she was Sugar Britches. Did that woman have tattoos or?
She had a bunny, like a Playboy bunny on in a nape of her back, you know, and his girls had those, you know. He called himself Mimp the Pimp. So and I don't know why they used that particular kind. I guess because he felt like his girls were Playboy bunny status. You know, I never asked those questions, but I'm just assuming that's why he would have gotten that particular branding for them. So again, I mean, it's just, you know, all different type of branding that actually happens, depends on the culture, what they're doing, if it's gang related or if it's just, you know, just part of the, you know, again, the family unit to identify all the girls that are related to this particular pimp, you know. So it just depends. And then a lot of times the girls are doing it just as self-will because, again, we don't believe that that's your pimp, that's your boyfriend. So you automatically, if he tells you to get his name tattooed on your neck, you're going to do it because you feel like that's even more significant to the world that I belong to him and he belongs to me, not realizing it's more of a commodity thing than it is a love thing.
The woman that you're talking about, it was your pimp too, or her was this a different guy or
no? These were brothers. When I was talking about it before, my best friend had two brothers, and one of them was already a known trafficker or pimp, and his brother was a low key drug dealer that had a drug problem himself. And he identified me as his project, and I identified him as my boyfriend manager. You know, we are going to do this together. We're going to learn how to get money together. So he didn't have anyone except for me at first. Then he started gathering other girls, you know, to come alongside of us. By that time, I think I stayed in that after we had about three young ladies, myself and two other young ladies, after which, you know, the girl that groomed me to work the truck stops, one day we got off in the morning and we talked a lot, and I was just tired of being there. I cried a lot. I just wanted out. I wanted to commit suicide. All kind of things was going through my head. And one day she just took it upon herself and told me, you know, normally they would drop us off, but she was driving a Cadillac that day, and she brought me home back to Milwaukee. And I never knew whatever happened to her, and I still don't, you know, but I'm sure that she got what was called violation because she went against the rules, you know. And he came looking for me. He came back to my mom's house, banged on the door, all kind of stuff. I never went back to him, though. And, you know, that kind of thing happened. That's what was my way out, God's way of getting me out of the game.
She got you out.
Yeah, she got me out. She drove me home.
Yeah, that must have been hard for her because of, like you said, you know, it's hard for any woman. It's like you almost have to turn on each other because you just don't want to. It's unsafe.
Absolutely. I mean, again, it's taught like a family culture. So you have the girl that has been with the guy the longest, or the one that he trusts the most, or the one that's making the most money. He identifies her as kind of like his right hand, or they call him the bottom B word. And she's the one that actually helps either to recruit, groom the other girls. And normally, a lot of times it's her friends or people that she knows, and she identifies their weakness or their vulnerabilities in the high schools, places they hang out, on Facebook, social media. And she talks about him as though he's not her boyfriend. Like, I met this really cool guy, you know, he has these kickback parties and we hang out and, you know, that kind of thing. So when that actually happens and you are ready to get out, yeah, it's kind of a hard pull because you've established not only the love that you believe you have from the guy, but also a sisterhood, so to speak, with the girls that you've been around and that you did the life with, because you confided in each other and you hung out with each other and you really wanted, again, to have family. And a lot of times we as those that are survivors or those that are still victims, that's one of the key factors. I want to be loved and accepted, you know. And if you had any trauma-based issues that dealt with your family that were unresolved, and your family were the perpetrators or people in your home touched you inappropriately, and you don't feel like you have trust at home, well, when the streets call you, you're coming and you'll stay, because it feels like at that point, at least you fit and people love you.
You know, I'm curious, like, how do you, when's like the last time that you saw a woman with a tattoo in the work that you're doing now?
I see them every Monday and every Thursday when I go back to the other location that I do the outreach training at, the on-site facilitating at. They have them now, you know, and if they're really like fresh out of the game, they'll tell you about them. They'll tell you about their tattoos and why they received them and why they have them, you know. And again, it depends on the culture or what kind of crowd they were hanging around, what those tattoos are significant for, you know. So you have the most of the girls now are more so doing the his name or his nickname kind of thing on a part of their body, whether it's their wrist and the inside of their wrist, or whether it's on the nape of their neck, whether it's directly on the side of their neck, on the front of their neck, by their throat, whether it's by the nape of their back. They have the tattoos indicating who this guy is, who this person is. I'm running into a lot of young ladies now that are having female traffickers. So the same rules apply. Same family culture apply. They'll put her name, her nickname, some significant part of their bodies. So the culture is shifting and it's changing. And I always want people to know it's never cookie cutter. It's not going to be the same as it was 10 years ago. The outcome is still the same. You're a commodity. You've been forced, manipulated through fraud or coercion into believing that something that's not, and you're part of something that you didn't realize how hard it is to get out of. But as long as it keeps generating income, there's always going to be somebody looking for a vulnerability of a child, male or female, to be pulled in and used for selfish gain.
I mean, do you feel like it's any better than the way it used to be with all the work that you've been doing and the experiences that you had? Do you think it's better now for women than it was before, or it's just this stuff is going deeper to remain hidden?
I think it is hidden in plain sight for sure, because again, it's not frowned upon as much as it should be. And it's too many categories that people create. However, we had a campaign called hashtag 1,000 more. And the reason being is because my son told me, my oldest son told me, Mom, you're a modern day Harriet Tubman. And I thought that was one of the coolest things ever, from my son recognizing the work that I was doing, till I realized what Harriet Tubman actually said when she said she saved 1,000, but she could have saved 1,000 more if they knew they were slaves. That slave mentality that happens in our culture, either is too high above somebody thinking their child could ever be pulled in, or too beneath somebody under their feet to say, why shouldn't they? Because if it's a poverty issue and you can bring money into the home, the parent or the mom may have turned her eye or a blind eye and a deaf ear to it. But then if it's on the higher scale, my child would never be involved because, you know, I've get them everything they want. But if they center it into believing that it's the vulnerabilities that lie in every child to be loved and accepted, then you can know that your child is at risk. So anytime that we can do one less, and we can wake up the mind of somebody that are raising children in our school systems, if we can do it in our non-governmental agencies, if we can do it on talk radio, if we can do it with our families that are raising children's foster care treatment, to watch for those warning signs and to be a participant in things that you don't know and get educated on what to do. And when young ladies call me, after they get out of these at-risk youth facilities and they don't want to do it anymore, and they've changed their heart and mind because of interactions that we've had, one less always makes a difference. So no matter how many there still are, if we can get one out, we're doing better than it was yesterday.
You know, I was reading something the other day about Milwaukee and how it was like considered one of the top 5 cities or something like that for the most activity for sex trafficking. Or, I mean, do you think Milwaukee is a hotspot, or do you think Wisconsin is a hotspot?
If we actually have statistics and data saying all 72 counties in Wisconsin has had a case of human trafficking, then I would say yes. But then you have to remember the data that's actually pulled in, and Milwaukee saying being known as the hub of human trafficking or the Harvard of pimp school, it's because it used to be a pimp culture here way back when it used to have those players balls and things like that. However, when you pull girls in that are under the age of 17 that can only be identified as traffic victims, then if they have those numbers based upon that, then they will believe that we are leading in that. But you have other places like Atlanta and Vegas and all these other places that you know that the culture there is a lot higher than ours. And it's just what's reported. So imagine what's not reported, or if you have to prove after 18 and older that you were trafficked because you can't consent to sex in exchange for anything of value under the age of 17. So I want to make sure that we are not known as that, along with all of our other collaborative partners that are doing the work, so that we can be known as the one that actually uncovers human trafficking so it's not hidden in plain sight, so that we don't use the ruse of boyfriend, girlfriend, making money, or it's okay, they consented, or there's nothing wrong with massage parlors or dance clubs or escort services, which are all a part of being trafficked. It's not just on the corner. It's not just chained to a radiator. It's not just in hotel rooms. It's all manner of things that I identify. If you are under the age of 17 and you consented to have sex for something in exchange of value, whether it was that person's love, attention, a place to sleep, a bag of marijuana, a pill, a heroin, whatever, you were just trafficked. Because that is the means and the definition. So we want to make things more clear than they are now so that people know that it's not just what we see on TV or the chatter around. We need to uncover all the ways that our youth are being exploited and make a difference.
Well, why do you think that culture exists? The one that, you know, makes it in some places easier for youth to be exploited?
Music, culture, TV, peer pressure, body shaming, wanting to fit in. Our youth right now are so, so inundated in image. It hurts them to not fit in, just like it was then. But at least now it's even worse because the music they listen to tells them it's okay. The dances that actually happen, all these Facebook challenges with twerking and doing this kind of stuff, it's just actually leading into me being able to be more promiscuous or doing things that shows that I'm available to do even more because it's welcomed. It's nothing is pointing the finger at it. The morality of it all, or showing that it's okay to be a virgin, has left the building, you know? So we need to go back to just putting a moral compass on it. It is okay to be a virgin. It is okay not to date. It is okay to wait until you're married. It is okay to talk to your parents about things, and parents, be available when your children have these kind of questions. Don't chalk it up as teenage rebellion. Don't just say they're being fast or they just won't listen and they'll grow out of it. It's just a phase. When they're screaming out to you with drastic change, like absence from school, hanging out with the wrong crowd, coming up with this money that you don't question, all of those things are red flags and warning signs for us that we need to pay attention to. But the main thing we need to do is continue to talk about no means no, regardless of what I'm saying no to, and being there as a support and provide resources.
You talked about the warning signs. What were some of the warning signs that your family missed?
Well, me start hanging out with an older crowd. I was a young girl hanging out with adults. Me staying out late, you know, my drastic change in behavior. A lot of things that they chalked up again as me being rebellious, me being fast-tailed, you know, that's what they called it. not questioning the fact of where was I at for the entire weekend, you know, not wondering how I got these new clothes and how was I getting my hair done. And why was this guy that's way older than me pulled up in front of our house, clearly a drug dealer with cocaine on his in the middle of his seat, but you let me get in the car with him and never question who he is, you know. So it was a lot of things I thought that should have been asked that wasn't. You know, but there was a lot of things that I should have said that I didn't. So I think that scale is equal. That balance is equal. If we say something that we don't understand or somebody does something that we don't get or think that we've been violated, we need to say it. But also mom, dad, caregiver, doctor, church person, whoever, you see something out of hand, you see something that doesn't line up, don't be afraid to ask. Because 9 times out of 10, that's all we're waiting for somebody to ask us. Do you see me? When you see me, what do you see? I'm screaming out for help, but don't know how to ask for it.
What do you think Wisconsin needs to change, or what can be done to help prevent it from happening to more people?
Just like you're doing right now, allowing available time, space, and opportunity to take off some of the covers, the blankets, take the blinders off the eyes, unstop the deaf ears, open up spaces where we can educate in different places where you believe it's not happening at, in the rural areas, in the suburbs, going to schools, you know, going inside churches, places where people feel sheltered and don't believe that it's happening in my neighborhood, you know. You have to start going into places in uncharted territories where people don't believe things are happening in order for them to understand that it is, and then we can take more action.
Or I don't know if you have a number, but do you have an idea of how many people you've helped through Fresh Start Learning?
Yeah, well, you know what? We have actually, upstairs, since our drop-in location have been open since October 4th of 2018, we have 97 guests come and stay with us. Out of those 97 guests, sometimes are repeat guests, but we've had 4 women go to drug and alcohol treatment. We had a few women go to transitional living to get their life back in order, where the young ladies at the at-risk youth facilities. I've been doing these trainings for going on 5 years now, and it's been hundreds of young girls that have gone through my training, and at least I can say about 10 of those young ladies have now gotten their lives in order. They still stay in contact, you know, and they still want to be involved with sharing their journey and being able to be empowered. But there's a lot of times that you help people out on the street that you don't know that you've helped, because they don't actually come back and tell you. But I'm sure that out of all the purses that we distribute to the Meta House and Joy House and out on the street in different organizations and programs, we give out over 100 purses per month. And it has a handwritten letter of love in it, resources in it. And I'm sure that those purses have allowed people to wake up and know that somebody cares. We've had a lot of phone calls in regards to that purse made a difference, and now they wanted to get their lives in order. So whatever we can do to make a difference, we're going to keep doing it. We're going to keep pushing that needle over so that it can continue to be one less every day, you know, that wake up to knowledge, understanding, give wisdom, how to get out of the game and stay out, or to provide knowledge-based tactics and techniques for those that don't know how to create resource hubs and to help your family or your youth to stay out of the game. You know, or just educate people on what to do, who to call, you know, what's the protocol of when you see something, say something. Don't become a superhero. Don't try to stop someone. Take down license plates. Call your local authorities. Call places that work with at-risk youth and adults that have been trafficked. So all of those things do make a difference.
Do you ever think about the woman that drove you home?
Yeah. I did for years, and every time that I'm allowed to have an open mic to speak and that part of it actually comes back up, I think about her just like I just did now. Where is she at? Is she still alive? I do know that my friend that I called my best friend then, she passed away years ago of cancer, so I do know that. Some of the ladies that I started out with that were on the same journey with, some of them are still out there right now. And some of them, you know, ended up having a stroke from using drugs. And some of them I just haven't heard from anymore. But that particular lady, I always want to know what happened to her. I said, God really used her to change the trajectory of my life and put me back on the path in which he had for me. Because I don't think that anything that ever happened in my life was for naught, because now I turn all that pain around into power to educate and to help others. So I wouldn't change anything, but I really would like to know what happened to her.
Do you think you would have gotten out if it hadn't been for her?
Eventually, I'm sure I would have been able to get out. I just don't think that it would have been as soon as. I don't know. I always say God has perfect timing. So that means that he heard my cries and my pleas at night when I was so tired of being there but didn't know how to get out. And he utilized her to help me to get out. So it was all God's timing, perfect timing. I'm just grateful for everything that I'm able to do on this side now as the modern day Harriet Tubman to make a difference.